This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Christopher Moonlight. He's a producer and director. Great having you on.
Thank you. It's great to be on. I'm really honored to be on your show. Thanks for reaching out and interviewing me.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pill Eater.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Pill Eater?
Good.
Chris, you're a director and producer. Can you talk about how you got interested in film, and especially your interest in the horror and sci-fi genre?
Well, it's definitely one of those when I was a wee lad type stories. I grew up in a small town after coming here from England. My dad was actually in the rock and roll industry. He used to manage a band people know as is Deep Purple. And he came here. We moved close to Hollywood, and I was immediately exposed to all of these fantastical movies, you know, stuff that Jim Henson did, of course, Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then I had an encounter with Alien, an H.R. Giger. And I was already an avid reader as a child. So there, I was just surrounded by all these fantastical things. And, you know, there'd be those behind the scenes specials about how they did stop motion and puppets. And I was just entranced. And I'm on the autism spectrum. So a bit of a fixation occurred. And
I'm sure both Pillator and I are too, to some degree as well.
Okay, so you know, you understand. So, you know, there was an obsession with storytelling. I had a very fantastical mind, and I think a lot of kids didn't understand that when I was, you know, most kids were communicating about normal things, you know, playing sports on the playground or, you know, I mean, they would talk about TV shows or. But the things that were going on in my imagination often crossed over into my conversations with other kids. And I think they just thought I was crazy, you know, it culminated in my mother taking me to a child psychologist to figure out what was going on in my head. And I kept saying, I want to do special effects. I want to do films. And my mom and dad, very well-meaning, you know, wanting to make sure that they had a happy, well-rounded child, would say things like, well, wouldn't you rather be an orthodontist or maybe study law? And, you know, and then I would go off about some alien creature and, you know, create some. I did, you know, as a little kid, I did haunted garages. I would scare the crap out of little kids at Halloween time by filling my garage with smoke machine smoke and strobe light and black light and rattling chains that would pull on strings. And so all of that stuff. Kind of as I became an adult, you know, I got into comic books. I was right next to Hollywood. I was meeting celebrities. Sometimes I wouldn't even realize I was meeting celebrities. Leonardo DiCaprio used to shop at a comic book store that I worked in. And I had no idea it was him. He would just come and buy comics and be like, dude, you should come see the new movie I'm in. I'd be, you know, like an idiot. Like, oh, you get a bit part? Are you an extra? And he'd be like, are you making fun of me? No. But as the technology, you know, I kind of meandered for a while, not being too sure about what I wanted to do. You know, I did comic books, I did art gallery stuff, but I was always kind of, because of my parents' very well-meaning suggestions of staying away from movies, that was always what other people did. Other people were successful at movies. I felt like I should just kind of, you know, find something else. But as the technology for making films became more affordable, and I met more and more people, I ended up doing things, you know, using my art talent, my puppet building, and my knowledge of special effects from all these behind the scene features. And suddenly I was meeting people like Ray Bradbury and Stan Lee, and Alec Gillis and Tom Woodruff Jr., who are the Oscar-winning special effects team behind Death Becomes Her, and they were nominated for Alien 3. And they were doing their own movie called Harbinger Down, and I got to help them with that. And, you know, after a while, I was like, no, I do want to do this. I can do this. So, you know, and I found that a lot of these people that I thought were, you know, just out there they were entirely accessible. You know, you can reach out to people and say, hey, I do this, and they dig it. And the next thing you know, you're making a movie, and it's a low budget movie, but you've kind of got the know-how and the talent. You bring people together, and suddenly, you know, it's like a $15,000 budget for my current movie, The Quantum Terror. But you know, the talent behind it and the resources that we had, I'm really happy with it. I think it looks amazing.
Are you still in a pre-production?
No, we actually shot the movie. So the right now I'm in Texas. I grew up in Hollywood, but I actually came to Texas because I wanted to try filmmaking as a small business model. And I have, you know, various fascinations with, I love watching Science Channel. I love quantum physics, although I don't understand the math behind it. I love the idea of it, all the crazy things that people think of, these crazy theories. And I love the occult, you know, that idea of like cultism and you know, scary cultists and you know, versus magic, the idea of magic. And I thought, you know, this kind of all comes together. I could turn it into a metaphor. And then, like I said, my friends Tom Woodruff and Alec Gillis directing, did Harbinger Down. And they just were, their movie was just full of crazy monsters and tentacles. And they were making it out of, I mean, they were making molds, but they were making stuff out of bubble wrap and were using reverse photography and miniatures. And I said to Alec, I said, hey, you're doing all this stuff with tentacles. I want to do tentacles too. I want to have crazy monsters. You know, do you mind? I'm not trying to ape your thing that you're doing. He's like, no, go ahead. I want to see, you know, it's like we've got the zombie genre and we've got the vampire genre. It's like, let's do it.
I think of like tentacles. I think of like Japanese tentacle porn.
You dirty bastard. You know, everybody thinks of it. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, there is definitely, I think whenever you do something that's allegorical or, you know, a metaphor, you know, you're going to kind of eventually enter into that Freudian territory when it comes to tentacles. And I joked with my lead actresses, because actually the lead protagonist character is a lesbian in the movie, and she has a lesbian girlfriend in the movie. And I actually wrote this script before it kind of started to become commonplace for lesbian characters to be integrated into stories. But I joked with my actresses, I said, metaphorically, this movie is essentially just about two lesbians running from penises.
Have you seen the movie Trolls 2?
I've seen parts of it, you know. I know it's entertaining to watch bad movies to an extent, but, you know, it's like this. There's a certain, comes a certain point where you're checking your watch going like, nah, I got stuff to do. But
I do like,
I promise.
I love the puppetry in that film, actually, in The Green, even though it might be it's considered the best worst film ever. There's some puppetry I like in that, and it just, maybe some of your puppet art reminds me of those kind of trolls, or like the Jim Henson. I don't know. There's something funny about that.
You see it in a lot of the 80s films, like the, yeah, like Jim Henson, David Bowie's Labyrinth film.
Beautiful movie. And, I got to say, though, I love movies. Like, for me, I can forgive almost anything in a movie, the quality of a movie, if there's a good story. And that's what we're really going for here. I think we've got a really great, unique story. But I actually love it when, I was talking to Alec Gillis about this, because one of his first screen credits was a Roger Corman movie called Battle Beyond the Stars. And, he's friends with James Cameron. And he said that, you know, when they first got started out, they were doing things like, you know, like, hey, this spaceship wall needs to look more interesting. And James Cameron would run to McDonald's and buy a bunch of like hamburger cartons and glue them to the wall and then spray paint them silver. And if you look at it closely, you're like, yeah, that's hamburger cartons. But, you know, at the same time, there's a charm to it. There's kind of a brilliance to it where you're like, yeah, you know, I can see that's hamburger cartons, but I actually love that they did that. They were on a budget and they got it done, and it, you know, you're still wrapped up in the story. Even if it's a goofy story, it's a well-told story. That's one of the things I always love about Roger Corman. You know, no matter how goofy his movies are, there's always a bit of a well-told story that's entertaining in there. So, you know, if you look at something and go, hey, that's like a hot dog container, or, you know, I've made space age weapons out of like strawberry quick milkshake tubs and Enfamil bottles when my kids were babies. You know, I love that sort of thing. As long as you kind of approach it with a level of sincerity, I have no problem with that. I think it's a lot of fun, and I kind of wish that. I wish audiences weren't so jaded these days. You know, everyone's kind of saying, well, the best special effects are the ones where you don't notice them or they're the most realistic. And I'm like, no, I want to see that charm. I want to see the fingerprints of the artist in that weapon that someone's carrying or that spaceship that's made out of milk cartons.
Okay. Did you like some of the more like avant-garde films like by the Czech director Jan Frank Majer, or like Alice and Little Odic? Have you seen some of his films?
You know, I don't think I have, to tell you the truth. But I do. I think one of the films that a couple of the films I really love that are like the older, more avant-garde films. I love the old Russian Jules Verne movies. They were almost made to look like they were printed on like the old printmaking technique where you can see the lines and the gears. And then, I love movies like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, those impressionist kind of their cardboard cutout sets where like the shadows are painted on and the trees.
With your the upcoming film, The Quantum Terror, it takes place in this underground labyrinth. Where did you, how did you sort of film? Was this on a set or did you go into like an actually underground like tunnels?
Well, I had always wanted to do an underground movie. Literal underground movie, not obvious. This is underground in terms of, independent film as well. But when I, again, going back to Studio ADI, who did the special effects for Alien 3, I was a huge Aliens fan. And when Alien 3 came out, I was a bit disappointed, but I was still blown away by the sets and the special effects. And I love the alien running through those tunnels. And where I lived as a kid, there were these concrete cylindrical drainage tunnels that if you were skinny enough, like I am, you could climb through. And, I got some friends to go down there with a camcorder, and I fully intended, and this is before the internet and before fan films were a thing, I fully intended to go down and make an Aliens fan film in this tunnel. And I had a friend with a camcorder and, but then the friends started dropping off. Oh, we're not really good. You know, I'd built puppets even as a teenager. I built like an alien head out of paper mache. And so when I moved into my current home, I noticed that there was a square wash tunnel right by my house. And I went, wow, it just goes through the other side. But what if I were to just film the actors pretending to crawl down into this tunnel and then take it to a set? So what I did was usually we used to live in apartments, and this is the first house that I've rented that had a garage. So I bought all these giant styrofoam sheets from Lowe's, and I hung them all over my garage and painted them with gray paint and sand mixed in the paint with the help of Jenna Green, who's a special effects artist. She was on season 4 of Face Off. Brilliant, brilliant effects artist, by the way. We had these concrete walls, these concrete tunnels in my garage that looked authentic unless you brushed up against them and they wobbled. I painted a green screen on one of the walls. And then, it's about 16 feet worth of tunnel. So we use what I call the Star Trek method, where they had the same hallway corridor set, but they just shoot it from different angles and have the crew, the cast keep walking through the same hallway over and over again. So it looked like there were miles of hallway. And then I have a miniature builder, Heather Lowe. She built scale miniature versions of the tunnels. And so we would do a lot of point of view shots where we'd have the actors react and then we would cut to a miniature and we would have a puppet that was supposed to be a giant monster, but it was actually just a foot and a half tall in this miniature tunnel. We'd shine some flashlights on it. And so it would look like the characters were reacting, or it does look like. I think we actually did a pretty brilliant job with that. So it looks like we've got these huge sets with these giant monsters, and it's all just done in miniatures with these close-ups of the actors reacting and running through the same tunnel over and over again. And it's worked rather beautifully, if I do say so myself. I think when people see it, they're going to wonder how we afforded such elaborate sets.
I just saw this low-budget British horror film. I think it was called, The Cutting Room. And it takes place in this kind of underground bunker. And even though it's low-budget, there's just something, really kind of disturbing and claustrophobic about being in this, underground tunnel setting.
I think that, for me, this labyrinth of tunnels kind of represents, without sounding too pretentious and artsy, kind of represents the human condition. And in the sense that, when you bring together a group of people, a group of characters, the story is really about them and how they interact and how they have to deal with a situation. So when you take them and put them in a claustrophobic situation where they can't immediately just get out, it's like the old problem with the haunted house story. If the house is haunted and they're in danger, why don't they just leave? So these characters are forced not only to confront the danger that's down there in the tunnel, but they have to confront themselves. They have to look within, and they have to look to the people who they're trapped down there with, and either come to terms with them or kill each other. So to me, that's what makes a story interesting. And again, Alec Guinness, who has been brilliant, very supportive of this film, when he did his film Harbinger Down, it was the same thing. They were trapped on a boat, but they, it was a very claustrophobic setting. And he said, look, it's like all these movies these days are about grandiose world endangering events where, every national monument's getting obliterated and everything hinges, the fate of the world hinges on the decisions that these characters make. And he's like, what happened to the little stories? What happened to the intimate stories? And I think that people are...
Sorry, there's this one science fiction book I really liked a few years ago, and it was by Brian Aldiss, and it was called Nonstop. And I think the year was late 50s. But this was an English science fiction novel. It was his first one, where it takes place on a galactic generation starship, but inside the starship it's a jungle, and there's only three characters in the novel. And there's kind of a twist ending to the book when it turns out it's not a galactical starship, but rather it's just a test subject of cultural anthropology by this advanced Earth, and they never were on this lost. But it reminds me that in deep grain pulp science fiction from late 50s, early 60s, you have more creativity where it's based upon narrative, the story, and especially as you were talking about the claustrophobic nature of setting and putting that science fiction pulp into film is something of a challenging effort.
And there was another horror film that I saw. I can't think of the name off the top of my head, but it was kind of, it deals with that claustrophobic theme. What happens is there's a drunk driver, and he ends up in this it's like some kind of abandoned hospital or abandoned warehouse, and he's traveling for all these labyrinths, and he ends up meeting his victim, and there's all these different people in the labyrinth who have wronged each other, and they later find out. And then I think in the end,
is that Saul?
No, it's not Saw, but okay. They find out they're in hell. But I can't think of the name off the top of my head.
That's funny.
Kind of sounds like a Harlan Ellison story called I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream.
Yes. I love that one, too. That's something of... It was a DOS game, too. And I played a little bit of the DOS game. I think, Robert, you might be right. But the film, I'm not so sure if there's a film adaptation on that. But yeah, in the fiction... I think you might be right.
I don't think there is, but it sounds familiar. I mean, but that's the beauty of, and that's the thing about the Quantum Terror as well. It's a horror movie, and it's got a lot of Lovecraftian aspects to it. But even Lovecraft in his horror writing had an element of science fiction, and there's an element of science fiction in my movie as well. And what I really love about good science fiction, it's not about spaceships flying around blasting each other and space fights. That's the Star Wars.
That's like E.E. Doc Smith and E.C. Tubb. That's what I'm thinking of, like pulp style.
The actual science fiction ideas, like with aliens, it's a very science fiction idea that someone would get on a lifeboat, a space lifeboat, and go into a hypersleep and wake up 57 years later. I mean, that just, that's kind of a Rip Van Winkle thing, but it wouldn't happen without a science fiction idea behind it. Or there was a very beautiful episode of Star Trek Voyager, which is my favorite Star Trek series, where the crew of Voyager landed on this planet and they encountered this kind of metamorphic goo that copied them. It made a precise copy of every crew member and the spaceship. And excuse me. And the spaceship took off from the planet and went flying through space, and they eventually forgot that they were this metamorphic goo. So you had this entire crew of Voyager and the ship that wasn't actually them, but they believed they were. And as they got further and further from their planet, they started to deteriorate and die. And you watch the entire episode, you watch the entire crew slowly deteriorate and die and try and figure out how to survive. And I was like, wow, that's a crazy good science fiction idea. But still, at its core, the story was an examination of the characters. What happens when these characters realize they're not who they think they are? And how do they react? How do they interact? How do they deal with it? And it was a heartbreaking episode, but I thought it was a beautiful science fiction idea. And I think those are the places that science fiction can take us, and horror can take us, that a lot of modern contemporary filmmakers generally don't want to go. You know, we still have a lot of, I have nothing against found footage, but we have a lot of redundant found footage.
There was a new remake of the Blair Witch film, and I actually like the Blair Witch series.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the original Blair Witch came out, and it was kind of when the internet was just starting to take off. And the beauty of that film wasn't actually the film itself, but the marketing campaign. People believed that this was real found footage. I mean, not everybody did. A lot of people were wise to it, and I was wise to it because I had friends coming back from film festivals telling me what a scary movie it was. But there were a lot of people that believed, no, this is real. And it was actually a town that they based it on, that, the people of that town were really pissed off because people were coming, trying to look for the Blair Witch. And it was kind of a phenomenon, that has never been repeated in the history of found footage since. It happened once before with Cannibal Holocaust, where the director actually was brought up on murder charges because then people actually believed that he murdered his cast to get a performance or something weird like that. But a lot of horror these days becomes redundant. It's another haunted house. It's another possessed. I mean, how many possession movies? And they cross over. I watched The Possession of Deborah Logan or The Taking of Deborah Logan.
There's like OG, and it's like the Ouija board or something. That's like
possession.
Yeah. It's
Are you a fan of Clive Barker?
Oh, I absolutely love Clive Barker. The Hellbound Heart, which subsequently became Hellraiser, was brilliant. I thought that the writer Peter Atkins, who took on the scripts for Hellraiser 2 and Hellraiser 3, was also brilliant. I love The Last Illusion, which was made into the Lord of Illusions film. It's a flawed film.
Film has that Labyrinth theme.
That was Nightbreed, right?
The second Hellraiser film.
Oh, the second. Oh, of course. Yeah, it absolutely did. And there's definitely, I would say, heavy influences from that in the Quantum Terror. I think if I would liken the Quantum Terror to anything, it's kind of like if David Lynch was hired to remake Aliens, but also Clive Barker was in there, talking to him about themes, and definitely there's definitely going to be moments in the Quantum Terror that anyone that knows Hellraiser 2 will look at and go, yeah, he was influenced by that. I mean, I'm taking a lot of influences from a lot of places. This is a very experimental film in the sense that it's almost like trying. I liken it to trying on your dad's boots, you know, when you're a little kid. This is my first feature film. I've worked on a lot of other people's films, and I've done short films, but this is my first feature film. So I'm trying out a lot of elements from people like Clive Barker and David Lynch and James Cameron and Ridley Scott and there's someone else I'm forgetting. But, you know, there's a lot of films I love that I'm directly borrowing from and experimenting with their elements. I think when people watch the film, they go like, oh, he's paying homage to this. And I don't know if I call it paying homage. It's more like, I like that. I want to try it myself and try it my way and see if I can do something a little bit different with it, spin it a different way and see what happens.
What do you think about the director, Alexander Hodorowski?
You know, he's a bizarre phenomenon because I have come across his movies in the past. But they never held my interest, and so I can't really comment on them. But I feel like there's more of a phenomena of Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary, where there's this kind of portrait painted of what could have been. And there's a very spiritual aspect to how Jodorowsky speaks. And, you know, he called, like H.R. Giger and Mobius and was a Tangerine Dream and, you know, and Salvador Dali, his spiritual warriors. Like he envisioned this movie that was going to change everything and open up people's minds.
Like the visual imagery of a Dali with like the soundtrack of a Tangerine Dream.
Yeah, I mean, and H.R. Giger, who was actually, that was supposed to be Giger's first movie, was Dune, not Alien. Because of Jodorowsky, and he knew Dan O'Bannon, and they loved his artwork, and that's what brought it to the attention of Ridley Scott, who put it in Alien. But I think that, you know, people are in love with this idea of this kind of, this amazing movie that never was, that could have altered the course of history, and I honestly don't buy into it. I feel like he's doing comic books now, and he's pursuing his vision. I think that's wonderful, but I'm a little suspicious of these artists who feel like they're going to cause some sort of social or spiritual awakening, or they've got something to teach. And I think that's great that you have something that you want to share, but I generally shy away from the idea of somehow enlightening people. I feel like that's the path of L. Ron Hubbard. You know, it's not I don't want to be a guru. I don't want to, you know, it's like I'm taking an emotional and spiritual journey and making a film, but I would never present the film as something that's going to enlighten other people. These, you know, when you make a film, when you make a piece of art, you're exploring an idea, and you're taking your audience on that exploration with you. They may learn something about themselves in that journey, and that's great, and they may come to some kind of enlightenment, but that's their connection to your art. That's within them. That's how they interpret it.
It often is most effective if it comes out as subconsciously as opposed to intentional.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's up to your audience what they get out of it. I think as soon as you start trying to dictate a philosophy or an idea, you've lost. Because I don't believe that any, you know, even the most brilliant human beings on this planet, you know, they may have some things to teach, but they don't have all the answers and they don't have the path to enlightenment. I think you have to find that yourself. And I think the people who feel like they're going to enlighten people, you know, that's a bit of narcissism. You know, I feel that the things that made, you know, writers like William Shakespeare so brilliant is Shakespeare. He just told it like he saw it. He created characters that were from his point of view, and he told stories that were explorations of his own ideas. But he never preached to you. He just gave you the story, and then different people will take away different things from it. You know, I think art is a fantastic thing that way. It's not complete until you have an audience to complete it. So, and that's why I'm so happy to be interviewed by people like you who have shows, who have an audience, is I get to tell people that my movie is coming. It's going to be out there and let them go see it. But it's not a finished work of art to me until I've engaged an audience. They complete the art, and I don't get to know what that is. I know what it is for me, but I'll never get to know what it is for them. And if it becomes something special for them, I mean, that's just the greatest feeling as an artist. That's the real accomplishment.
Can you talk about your upcoming film, Girl in the Window?
Aha, Girl in the Window. Girl in the Window is a project of mine that I just cannot let go. I actually shot it 5 years ago on DV tapes, and the idea was to create this this super sexy grindhouse-style sci-fi movie that was completely over the top. I was inspired by Robert Rodriguez, who I actually don't like most of his films. There's a couple he's done that I think are pretty good, but for the most part, like I just come away from his movies shaking my head because I love the way he makes films, but I don't particularly like the films he makes. I think Planet Terror and Sin City were pretty good. And I got to admit, he's making Alita Battle Angel out here in Texas right now. A couple of my actors have actually had the pleasure of being a part of that movie, too. But he came out to, before I moved to Texas, he came to the San Diego Comic-Con. And I was thinking about moving to Texas at the time, and he talked about what a wonderful place Austin was and how he loved making films and that, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on there. So I went, okay, I'm going to pick up and move to Austin and check out the film scene there. But before I do, I'm going to get some friends together and we're going to shoot this all green screen, crazy sci-fi shoot 'em up. And I'm going to call it Girl in the Window. It's essentially Rapunzel in kind of an R-rated Star Wars universe meets El Mariachi, Desperado, just crazy, sexy, and violent. And so I got some actors together. I got a very good friend of mine who's a brilliant actor named Jeremy Haynes and a few other actor friends of mine together. And I wrote this short film script, about a 20-minute short film. And we shot it. And then I came to Texas and I was broke, so I had to shelve it. But every time I go back and look at the footage, the performances are brilliant. And I had this really great actress play the lead character of the alien girl in the window. She's locked up in this tower, and the hero, anti-hero.
Is this Emily Blum?
I have briefly spoken to Emily Blum about filling the role, but it's only been that as a brief communication about the possibility. I think she's fantastic. We had another actress who we actually shot her scenes, and then she had a conflict because she had some other things going on, and she's a friend of mine. So I said, look, I don't want to ruin anything for you, so we're gonna shelve your footage and we're gonna find another actress. So yes, I did have a brief communication with Emily Bloom about it, but it was only a brief communication, nothing more. No auditions have been made. Nothing else has been said, but if she is interested in it, which she expressed on Twitter, then I would love to have her because I think she's absolutely brilliant. I love the she's got that new cosmic I forget what she calls it. I'm blocking on it, but it's like a cosmic photo set that she did with green screen paint. And I thought it was.
Oh, yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And I was like, that's the kind of thing I want this movie to be like. I want it to be like crazy, over the top, violent and sexy, and have someone, an actress with the personality and the boldness to pull that off. Now, you know, like I said, if it's Emily Bloom, that would be fantastic, but it may not be, you know, she has to actually express an interest to the point where, you know, we come to the table and talk about it. But I was absolutely thrilled that she expressed on Twitter that, you know, that was something she'd be interested in. But if it's not her, I would definitely show her to other candidates and say, like, look, this is what I'm aiming for. This is the level that I'm looking to fill. So, yeah. You know, that would be fantastic. But I can't say that, like I said, I can't say that she's done anything more than express a passing interest at the moment, which is exciting, but it's pie in the sky until I get to talk to her more.
Can you talk about your Ray Bradbury documentary?
Well, it wasn't my Ray Bradbury documentary. I wish it was. Essentially, I was approached by a producer named Michael O'Kelly, who is a friend of Ray Bradbury's, and Ray Bradbury is a childhood hero of mine. I think he's probably one of the most fantastic authors ever, and I've met him several times. I've seen him speak several times. I read, I can't say all of his books, but I was approached by this producer, Michael O'Kelly. And he was friends with Ray Bradbury, and he was co-producing this documentary, which was supposed to be not just a documentary about his life, but a look inside Ray Bradbury's philosophy and imagination. It's called Live Forever, The Ray Bradbury Odyssey. And we came in on a very low budget. I brought in my friends Jeremy Haynes, once again, another friend of mine named Rich Goddard, and a brilliant, brilliant artist, model builder named Dave Grave. Death rock legend in Hollywood, actually founded the band Voodoo Church, and also is the frontman to the band Frankenstein. He came in and built miniature Ferris wheels. I built goblin puppets that we puppeteered underwater. And we did all sorts of stuff with After Effects and green screen on a very low budget. And we were showing it to Ray. I mean, Ray Bradbury was aware of who we were and what we were doing, and he loved it. You know, Hugh Hefner did an interview and talked about Ray, and Joe Mantegna and Edward James Olmos and Malcolm McDowell. Malcolm McDowell was playing Mr. Electrico, one of Ray Bradbury's childhood heroes, is in front of a green screen waving a sword around, shouting, "Live forever!" And I was getting to create carnival special effects around him and lightning bolts shooting out of his sword and this amazing stuff. And it was really exciting, but unfortunately, I mean, I guess I'm proud to say that I worked on the last project that Ray Bradbury was working on before his death. But, unfortunately Ray passed, in the early summer, in the middle of making the documentary. And the documentary was finished, but I think without Ray's guidance, it was completed, but it wasn't completed the way it needed to be completed. And, you know, God bless Michael O'Kelly. You know, he really put everything he had into it. But, you know, it had a premiere and it was well received. But I personally felt that it still needed some work, and that was kind of the consensus the last time that I had anything to do with the project. But I had to leave the project because there wasn't anything going on beyond that. And, you know, maybe it will one day again. I would certainly like to see Ray Bradbury get the documentary he deserves. But, you know, he's a very important figure to me, and I think he's the kind of figure the world needs right now. He was not just a science fiction writer or a fantasy writer, but he was a philosopher. And I believe that he definitely saw the world in the light that I think would be a guiding light to a lot of people who feel lost right now. I think his philosophies could definitely help a lot of people find their way. Certainly has helped me find my way in life. So I hope more people with books like Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles, I hope there's a renaissance of Ray Bradbury, and we get to see more of that. And hopefully the documentary will be revived again.
What about you also have Moonlight Art Magazine. I was looking at that, and it kind of reminds me of this old goth period. Do you like the whole goth subculture?
Well, I came out of the goth subculture in the 90s and the early 2000s. Definitely, one of the first projects I ever did actually was a goth zine that I called Mary's Mother's Scream, based on the legend of how when Mary Shelley was born, the creator of Frankenstein, her mother had this kind of ear-piercing scream that was described at her birth that stuck with Mary Shelley and inspired Frankenstein later. And I did interviews with goth bands, and I did a comic in there called The Black Lipstick Curse. And I, you know, I had a fun story in there called I Am the Vampire Cat. And from there, you know, I wanted to kind of expand and interview artists, but still do the comics. So I've done some comics in there, and it's a free download. I'm assuming that you downloaded it yourself. I've done it in several incarnations. It was a print magazine for a while. I did like four issues as a black and white, and then I tried to do it. I tried doing an annual volume in color, and then I did the free online version. And every time I did it, you know, it was kind of one of those things where it was so difficult to pull it together, to get all the interviews together and to do the comics and I just kind of wanted to move on to other projects. But it's definitely something, you know, I interviewed amazing artists who inspired me in there, you know, J.H. Williams, David Mack, Dame Darcy, Billy Martinez, just amazing art. Eddie Campbell, who did From Hell with Alan Moore, you know, and it was definitely an inspiration. But I think after a while, you know, I did interviews on my YouTube channel with a lot of these artists as well. Cami DiErico.
Do you know of a
brilliant interview?
No, I'm sorry. Did you know of Jonan Vasquez?
Jonan Vasquez?
Yes.
Who did Johnny the Homicidal Maniac and mm-hmm. Squee. I know of him. I never met him. Mm-hmm. You know, his thing was like he was more on the ridiculous side. Like he loved doing these over the top characters that were just, you know, crazy and goth, and I liked that too. My characters in The Black Lipstick Curse were always more like, I always called it like the gothic Archie comic, you know. It's like characters were always trying to like pick up on girls, and you know, but these weird things would happen, you know. It's like they would be in the middle of you know, going to a goth club, but then they'd find out that one of their friends had cancer, and they'd have to deal with that. And It's another thing I would like to pick up at some point. It might make a good movie as well, because it's roughly based on my life at that time. You know, it's like I did know these very eccentric characters, but they were very wonderful people and very human, loving people that I still have a lot of a great respect for to this day. So I would love to one day do a movie or revitalization of The Black Lipstick Curse, where I actually get to show that time period. I mean, that would be the wonderful thing. You know, it's like that 70s show or or Dazed and Confused, but actually show that time period of the goth scene in the 90s, and you know who the bands were and what the people were like, and what it was like in a pre-internet era. You know, we weren't glued to our phones, we weren't hanging out on the computers, we were getting out there, and it was raw and it was really cool. And you know, I feel like that's something that I would love to expose the next generation to.
It seems also like that technology today plays a part of art creation, and without the internet and programs like if you have Photoshop or you make electronic music in Reason, then you know, a lot of music creation has been happening. And now, I don't know if this term is right, but do you think now today we're in this post-cyberpunk culture where everything has to do 100% about the internet, even from recording this interview with a program called Skype right now? It's so strange to think about that.
Well, it, you know, it's nothing stays the same. So, you know, if I were to sit here and, you know, do this interview and lament about how it was so much better in the 90s because there was no internet, you know, I mean, that would just be bull to me, because like I said, everything changes. And what's interesting to me is we're still human beings, and the art we create with the technology is reactionary. And that is what art is about, isn't it? I mean, you look at, you know, the Renaissance paintings or cave paintings going back even further, or, you know, the Egyptian hieroglyphics or Impressionism. Impressionism was kind of a result of, you know, the camera being invented, and suddenly people didn't need to hire realistic portrait painters anymore to get portraits of their family. They got, you know, they just took a picture. And so painters had to go, well, wait a minute, we have to do something different, because we've just become irrelevant. What we were doing before just became irrelevant. And so that was reactionary. And so I'm actually very excited about all this digital technology. Are there drawbacks to it? Sure. You know, I think the technology is kind of making us a bit more disconnected as a society. A little, you know, we're completely fine with engaging each other online and getting into fights and debates and demonizing each other. And it's easy. And, you know, that part of it's kind of horrible. You know, we're not taking the time to interact with each other and see each other as human beings. But at the same time, we recognize that. And so we are creating art that acknowledges it and explores those ideas and tries to make sense of it. And, you know, we're still trying to better ourselves. And like I said, I would not be able to make a movie like The Quantum Terror without digital technology. You know, I've got a DSLR camera. I've got, you know, a computer that I'm editing in. I'm working with After Effects and Photoshop and Adobe Premiere and Adobe Audition to clean up the sound. And I've been liberated by that. And I do believe that the movie I'm making is, you know, is something that, you know, I hope it's a good movie, but, you know, you hope that maybe 100 years from now, somebody will look back at the piece of art you created and go, aha, this piece of art is the way it is because the artist was reacting to the time that he lived in. And, you know, just like you get books like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that was reactionary to the 1960s, you know, or you get books like The Incredible Shrinking Man that were reactionary to the 1950s. You get Stephen King, who's reactionary to the 70s and the 80s. You read those books and you kind of feel the era that they were written in. And, you know, and sometimes people call that being dated. But I think that there's, you know, there's always the timeless element of the human condition within your stories that everyone can relate to. That's the difference between writing a story and writing literature. Or, you know, creating a great work of art is both timeless and reactionary. So, you know, I'm not bothered by technology in that sense. You know, I'm more bothered with the way human beings are behaving towards each other right now. You know, kind of feeling like people who disagree with someone's point of view are therefore somehow evil and less than human. I think that's kind of an extreme reaction. But I believe that the technology that we have, it's all part of it. It's part of the artistic process, and I want to use it. I want to be a part of it. I want to see what it turns into, because I love practical effects, and I love old school methods, and I use those too because they're a part of what I grew up with. But if I did not utilize the technology at my disposal right now, I feel like I would be cheating myself out of participating with modern society. And as an artist, I feel that's my duty to do that.
And also with technology, as you said, there's a lot of pros and cons, but it does enable filmmakers to do more stuff on a lower budget. In the past, if you wanted to do something like really grandiose, you needed this massive budget, but there's so much you can do. I mean, even with like a green screen, there's a lot of, you could put in a whole background and it could look totally realistic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the green screen now, I just, you know, it's still a process to make it look good. But if I wanted to do a green screen back in the 80s or a blue screen, it would have been a blue screen back in the 80s. I would have had to have a multi-million dollar film processing facility, because they would literally shoot 5 different motion controlled plates, strips of film that would then be processed through a machine that would combine those 5 strips of film, those 5 plates, into one image. And it was, you know, done by hand. They were hand cranking that and making sure it all lined up. Now I'm just doing it one guy and a computer. The Quantum Terror would be a several million dollar movie, probably, maybe like a million and a half dollar movie if it was made in the 80s. You know, I'm getting away with a lot by having, you know, actors and crew work below their budget and a lot of volunteers. I think that the Quantum Terror would actually probably be $100,000 movie now. You know, but I lucked out. I managed to boil down the budget to $15,000 and put in a lot of sweat equity, as Alec Gillis, as another term I borrowed from Alec Gillis, would say. But yeah, you know, this movie is possible because of technology, and I think that's wonderful. You know, I can't afford film. I can't afford film processing. I cannot afford being in a cutting room. This is all being done in my house, in my upstairs office, in my living room, in my kitchen, in my garage, you know, a couple of locations, you know, around my house on the outside, and a bunch of miniatures made out of styrofoam and bubble wrap and Sculpey clay and springs that I pull out of soap bottles. And, you know, it's like, if you were to take that to a major studio, they would think you were insane and they would tell you no. And if you were to do that in the 80s, you know, they wouldn't even let you in the door. So absolutely. I think, you know, the embracing the technology, not being afraid of it, you know, just remembering to be a human being. No, I think we're getting some great stuff. I think that there's really interesting things happening at the moment, and a lot of them on the independent level. Because the movies, they've got the millions and millions of dollars budget. They, you know, they're just doing what they've always done with the most expensive technology. It's the artists with the limitations, I think, are creating like movies like the next Evil Dead or the next Reanimator, those low budget movies that became cult classics because they were so genius in their creativity within those limitations.
There's also, if you're an independent filmmaker, there's a lot more freedom of creativity. If you're in Hollywood, you're kind of under pressure, like what specifically is going to be like profit driven. You have to make like a certain multi-million dollar profit. So things end up becoming very formulaic, and you can make a lot of money, but you do lose that sense of a freedom of creative expression.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that there's a, you know, I've had a lot of I've heard a lot of stories about people who have suffered from just that. You know, and it's the reason that I left Hollywood. I mean, I'll be back to Hollywood. I am going to come back to California and be a part of Hollywood again, believe me. But I wanted to get away, so I had the creative freedom and the freedom to take the risks, because I think it's the really popular stuff. I mean, we have Ash versus the Evil Dead now. It's this really successful horror TV series that would have never existed if we didn't have someone like Sam Raimi taking a chance on Evil Dead, you know, getting, like, what was his dentist that invested in it? You know, but if you go to Hollywood, even on the low budget level, you know, or even just on the independent level completely, you're surrounded by people who, you know, unions or producers or whatever telling you can't do this, and our demographic is this, and our algorithms say that you have to have a puppy in this scene, and you know, and they just, you know, they start, you know, you've got this piece of art that you're trying to create, and they're just all there with their kind of like sanding belts, like trying to get all the rough edges off of it, and they just sand away all the things that are its character that makes it original, that makes it interesting. And it may be something that fails and falls flat on its face. I mean, that's why I like to work in the low budget, because even if I don't make that much money, I'm on such a low budget that, you know, I can still make my money back and maybe then some, so I can make the next movie. But, you know, here doing this, I'm free to take chances and do bizarre things that may not work, or they may take off and be brilliant, you know. But I think that movies like mine and other people who take chances, even their failures are more interesting, more engaging than some of these kind of homogenized successes. And I wanted to make sure that I could get away and try it my way, do it my way before I, you know, so when I got back there, you know, people would say like, well, why don't we do it like this? And I could say, look, I did it my way and it was successful. Why don't you listen to me and give it a chance? Of course, in Hollywood, that generally doesn't happen. I mean, you've got directors who have made brilliant independent films, and then they get to Hollywood and they essentially just become, you know, like an accessory. Like the producers are essentially just pushing them around, going, shoot it like this, right in this scene. We want to see this, do this. And the director just has to do it because suddenly they're under contract and it's a bummer, you know? So, I mean, if somebody showed up from Hollywood and say, hey, we've got this big check, will you come and direct our film? I'd be like, yeah, of course, you got the big check, no problem. But I would probably take some of that big check and go make another low budget film and do it my way. And I bet I would make more money on it, and I bet it would be more successful. That's, you know, that might sound a bit arrogant, but, you know, I'm getting too old to care about how I sound to other people. I just want to create my art, and I think it'd be something good. You know, I think people are going to see the Quantum Terror, you know, go to the blog that I have, the quantumterror.blogspot.com, and go through the articles I've written about the process, the photos that I've taken. I think you'll see that it's going to be really interesting and fun, and there's a trailer up, and when it comes out, people are going to dig it, man. And they're going to talk about it. That's the thing that I'm most excited about. I think I've got the kind of movie that once the credits roll, you know, if you're sitting on the couch watching it on demand, you turn to the people that you're watching it with and go like, well, what'd you think that was about? And you start talking about it because it actually gave you some substance, something to think about.
Do you have an official release date?
I don't. You know, I was very much hoping to have it out in January, but it's one of those things where we've done so many, we actually have done a lot of special effects with this, a lot of practical effects, a lot of puppets, a lot of miniatures, but there's been a lot of green screen, and I'm pretty much doing it by myself at this point. The post-production is, you know, I've got people coming in and helping me puppeteer, and I've had a brilliant cast and crew during production, but the post-production process, you know, I am aiming for March. I would like to have it out in March. I definitely like to have it out before the summertime. It'd be really cool if I had it out around the same time as Alien Covenant. I'm really looking forward to that movie. I love Ridley Scott, and I actually did really enjoy Prometheus. So, you know, it'd be fun to have a movie like people go, hey, we just saw Alien Covenant. Hey, there's this kind of alien knockoff looking film on demand. Let's watch that too. And then be surprised at how unique it actually is. So I'm aiming for March, but I can't say for sure at the moment. The most important thing for me is not to get it out by a certain time, but to make sure that it's the best movie that it can possibly be. You know, I'm doing something really interesting. It's social commentary combined with the occult, quantum physics, and a lesbian love story. I mean, how many films can say that?
That actually sounds like a very interesting movie. I'm actually looking forward to that. I mean, I do like both movies a lot. And I'm not much of a film watcher right now, but the old school films that I tend to really enjoy, there's this old genre of film that I discovered through this one book called folk horror. It's this strange genre of film like The Wicker Man and one film is called Penda's Fen. These are like films that were on BBC during like 60s, 70s. They had very strange synth soundtracks, and the film was very grainy. Some of them cannot be found anymore. Very strange. It music-wise, too, it has an aesthetic to these films. But for Chris's films, it reminds me of something new and fresh that's in the, you know, tradition of Hellraiser or something of that, of Lovecraft and even Alien.
And you said in your upcoming film that you want to kind of pay homage to those films from the 60s and 70s and 80s. Do you have a particular decade in mind, or just kind of the aesthetics of all of them combined?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, a lot of these movies from, you know, modern movies and movies from the 60s and 70s would play. So they're all kind of there in my mind as kind of one experience, one childhood experience. I loved, you know, as far as Girl in the Window goes, I loved Forbidden Planet. I loved Green Slime. I loved Planet of the Vampires. I loved, I didn't love Barbarella. Barbarella was terrible, but it was still, you know, it still had a look to it that was, you know, 1960s. And like Pill Eater said, grainy film, scratches in the film. And then I love that Robert Rodriguez did that grindhouse version of his film Planet Terror. And I was like, yeah, why can't we do that? Why can't we scratch up the film, dirty it up, make it, you know, like that, and do really over the top, you know, sexy sci-fi, shoot 'em up with spaceships and aliens and ridiculous stuff.
Have you considered releasing your movie on VHS tape and kind of like re-releasing it, not in like DVD or Blu-ray, but for the aesthetic wise of just limited to like 500 VHS tapes if you had a fan following?
If I had the opportunity to do that, I definitely would. I mean, it's the beauty of video on demand is that I can do it for very little money, which I have very little money. But I would love to do it on VHS tapes. You know, you play those VHS tapes, they have a quality to them. You know, they actually do look really great on your TV, even in comparison to Blu-rays, I feel. So I would love to do that sort of thing. You know, with as far as, you know, I mean, yeah, that's what I watched a lot of these movies on, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then, you know, I don't have a VHS player at the moment, but I still have my tapes. I still have David Lynch's Lost Highway, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. I have Hellraiser. I have Return of the Living Dead 3, which I think is the most brilliant zombie movie. That and Corpse Bride. I think Corpse Bride is a brilliant one too. You know, but I those movies definitely, Reanimator, From Beyond, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing, Angel Heart, you know, these, I mean, you can get these on Netflix too, but you know, it's like, not all of them. You know, you watch Nightbreed. I don't think Nightbreed is the most successful of Clive Barker's movies. I prefer Lord of Illusions. That's flawed too, but it's still gets more brilliant with each viewing, as far as I'm concerned. I have that on VHS as well. So, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm definitely taking from these movies. And I love the idea of dirtying up the film, getting it grainy and but I also love that you can do that digitally now. I love that you can make that a style, and then you can kind of enhance that style in a way that was never part of the original. You know, you can add your own spin to it, and then that becomes a thing. But yeah, this idea of these more obscure movies, you know, I always loved Lucio Fulci's Zombie and The Beyond and the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, these are movies that, you know, people know about them now, but at the time, you know, they were obscure movies I was watching with friends, and most people didn't go to see them or know that they existed or cared to see them. Now they're, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff now that goes on YouTube, too, and I think YouTube is now its own genre, because the internet, how you're going to put this physically, I don't know, but it's there in this internet space as digital. Somebody's going to have to burn this to their computer, put it away, and if, like, the YouTube admins take down this experimental, I guess, YouTube poop or some strange avant-garde messing with colors, then, you know, I think there's going to be this whole generation in the next 10 years of a whole genre of art films on YouTube. I mean, there's so much now in the digital age, we can learn anything about whatever genre of things. I mean, I found about Full Car through online, actually, and there was a book called, I have it, I think it's Full Car Anthology, and it's completely this genre made up in the past 3 years, which assumes that these English BBC films that are grainy from the 60s and 50s are actually scary and have some kind of horror. It's scary, but it's not intentionally scary, and people find it scary just because it's eerie or something.
We are at the end of the show, so I would like to thank Christopher Moonlight for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Also, thanks, Pillator.
This has been a wonderful discussion about films. This is cool.